Chapter 11. The Heritor. Kill us! Kill us all! In the name of Terra, before he... Transcript of last broadcast from Rixus 5, the first inherited world. Level sub-40 was almost a kilometre underground, deep in the foundation structure of the main spine. An armoured lift cage with grilled sides transported Gaunt down the last 300 metres, lowering him into an underworld of dark, damp stone, stale air, and caged sodium lamps. He entered an underground concourse where groundwater dripped from the pipework roof onto the concrete floor and rusting chains dangled over piles of mildewed refuse. Along one side was a row of wooden posts with shackle loops at wrist height. The wall behind the posts was stippled with bullet pox and darkly stained. Gaunt approached an adamantine shutter marked with yellow chevrons. Rock-crete bunkers stood on either side of the shutter, blank except for letterbox slits set high up. As he moved forward, automatic spotlights mounted above the hatch snapped on and bathed him with blue-white light.
"Identify,"
a voice crackled out of a vox relay. "Colonel Commissar Ibrahim Gaunt," Gaunt replied curtly, reeling off his serial number afterwards.
"Your business."
"Just open the shutter." There was a brief pause, then the great metal hatch screeched open. Gaunt stepped through and found himself facing a second shutter. The one behind him slammed shut before the inner one would open. Inside the stockade, a caged walkway led down into a dispatch area with an open-sided shower stall and low tables for searching through personal effects. The sodium lamps gave the fetid, recirculated air a frosty hue. Guards moved out of side bunkers to meet him. They were all VPHC troopers, dressed in black shirts, black peaked caps, graphite grey breeches, and black boots. Each one wore orange armbands and wide black leather belts with riot batons and cuffs dangling from them. Three carried pump-action shotguns.
"Grismond," Gaunt told them briefly.
He allowed himself to be frisked and handed over his bolt pistol. Two of the guards then led him through a series of cage doors with remotely activated electric locks, down the austere, red-washed hallways of the cell block. There was an astringent ammonia stink of open drains, with a mouldering aftertaste of deep rock and soil. Every sound rang out and echoed. Grismond and the four officers arrested with him were sharing a large communal holding tank. They still wore their mustard-brown Narmenian uniforms, but caps, belts, laces, and all rank pins had been removed. Grismond met Gaunt at the cage door. The VPHC guards refused to open it, so they were forced to talk through the bars.
"I'm glad to see you," Grismond said.
He was pale, and there was a dark look of anger in his eyes.
"Get us out of this."
"Tell me what happened, in your own words," Gaunt said. Grismond paused, then shrugged.
"We were ordered to Vevey. Thanks to the gross idiocy of House Command Organization, the routes were blocked. I took my column off the roadway and headed onto the gate through an industrial sector. Next thing I knew, the VPHC were heading me off."
"Did you disobey any direct order?"
"I was ordered to Vevey," the man repeated. "I was told to take arterial route GH7M. When I couldn't get through, I tried to achieve my primary order to reach the appointed front line."
"Did you strike a VPHC officer?"
"Yes. He drew a gun on me first, without provocation."
Gaunt was quiet for a moment.
"You'd think these bastards didn't want us to fight for them," growled Grismond.
"Their pride is hurt. The inadequacies of their command systems were shown up clearly today. They're looking for others to blame."
"Screw them if they try to pin anything on me. This is crazy. Won't Sturm back you up?"
"Sturm is too busy trying to please both sides. Don't worry. I won't let this continue a moment longer than it has to." Grismond nodded. Loud footsteps, unpaced and overlapping, reverberated down the dank cell block behind them. Gaunt turned to see Commissar Tarion enter with an escort of VPHC troops.
"Commissar Gaunt, you shouldn't be here. The Narmenian insubordination is a matter for the VPHC disciplinary review. You will not interfere with Vegasian military justice. You will not confer with the prisoners. My men will escort you back to the elevator."
Gaunt nodded to Grismond and walked over to the VPHC group, facing Tarion for a moment. "You are making a mistake both you and your cadre will regret, Tarion." Is that some kind of threat, Gaunt? You're a commissar, Tarion. Or at least you're supposed to be. You must know commissars never issue threats. Only facts. Gaunt allowed himself to be marched out of the stockade. The 33rd dawn was already on them, with heavy rain falling across the entire hive, the outer habs, and the grasslands beyond. Marshal Crowe was taking breakfast in his retiring chamber off the war room when Gaunt entered. The room was long, gloomy, and wood-panelled, with gilt-framed oil paintings of past marshals lining the walls. Crowe sat at the head of a long, varnished mahogany table, picking at food laid out on a salver as he read through a pile of data slates. Behind him, the end wall of the room was armoured glass and overlooked the Commercia and shield pylon. Backlit by the great window and the grey morning glare, Crowe was a dark, brooding shape.
Commissar?
Gaunt saluted. Marshal, the charges against the Narmenian officers must be dropped at once. Crowe looked up, his noble white-haired head inclining towards Gaunt like an eagle considering a lamb.
Because?
Because they are utterly foolish and counterproductive. Because we need officers of Grisman's standing. Because any punishment will send a negative message to the Narmenian units and to all guard units as a whole, that Vervenhive values the efforts of the off-world forces very little.
And what of the other view? You heard it yourself. One rule for Verven, one for the guard.
We both know that's not true. Grisman's actions are hardly capital in nature, yet the VPHC seems hell-bent on prosecuting them to the extreme. I'm not even sure this so-called insubordination was even that. A tribunal would throw it out, but to even get to a tribunal would be damaging. Narmenian and guard honor would be slighted, and the VPHC would be made to look stupid. At the last minute, Gaunt managed to prevent himself from saying, even more stupid.
Tarion's stuff is very thorough. They would not undertake a tribunal if they thought it would collapse.
I am familiar with such courts, Marshal. However, that will only happen if the VPHC are allowed to run the hearing themselves.
It is their purview. Military discipline. It's Tarion's job.
I will not allow the VPHC to conduct any hearing. Crowe put down his fork and stared at Gaunt as if he had just insulted Crowe's own mother. He rose to his feet, dabbing his mouth with a napkin.
You won't allow it?
Gaunt stood his ground. Imperial Commissariat Edict 4378B states that any activity concerning the discipline of Imperial Guardsmen must be conducted by the Imperial Commissariat itself, not by planetary bodies. It is not Tarion's responsibility. It should not be a matter for the VPHC.
And you will enforce this ruling?
If I have to. I am the ranking Imperial Commissar on Vergast.
The interpretation of law will be murderous. Any conflict between imperial and planetary rules will be argued over and over. Do not pursue this, Gaunt.
I'm afraid I have to, Marshal. I am not a stranger to martial hearings. I will personally resource and provide all the legal precedents I need to throw Tarion, his thugs, and his pitiful case to the wolves. A Vervan primary adjutant hurried into the retiring room behind Gaunt.
Not now,
barked Crowe, but the man didn't withdraw. He held out a data slate to the fuming marshal.
You need to see this, sir,
he stammered. Crowe snatched the slate out of the man's hands and read it quickly. What he read arrested his attention, and he went back and reread slowly, his eyes narrowing. Crowe thrust the slate to Gaunt.
Read it yourself, he said.
Our observers along the South Curtain have been picking it up since daybreak.
Gaunt looked through the transcripts recorded by the wall guards as they scrolled across the glowing screen.
Heritor Asphodel, he murmured.
He looked round at Crowe.
I suggest you release Grisman now. We're going to need all the men we can get.
Gaunt and Crowe left the retiring room together and strode down the short hall into the great control auditorium of House Command. Both the lower level and the wrought iron upper deck of the place were jostling with activity. Hololithic projections of the warfront glowed upwards into the air from crenellated lens pits in the floor, and the air throbbed with voxcaster traffic, astropaths' chants, and the clack of the cogitator banks. A gaggle of Munitorum staffers, Vervan primary aides, and technical operators hastened forward around the marshal as he entered, but he waved them all away, crossing to the ironwork upper deck, his boots clanging up the metal steps. Vice Marshal Anko, General Sturm, Commissar Kaul, and General Zantz of the North Col were already assembled by the great chart table. Silent servitors, encrusted with bionics, and poised regimental aides waited behind them. An occasional voxed pick drone bumbled across the command space. Gaunt hung back at the head of the stairs, observing.
"Kaul?" asked Crow, approaching the chart table. "No confirmation. It is impossible to confirm, Lord Marshal."
Crow held up the data slate.
"But this is an accurate transcript of the enemy broadcasts. They're chanting this at the gates."
"Since dawn," replied Sturm. He looked bleary-eyed, and his gray and gold Volpone dress uniform was crumpled, as if he had been roused hurriedly, "and not just chanting." He nodded, and a servitor opened a vox channel. A chatter of almost unintelligible noise rolled from the speaker. "Vox Central has washed the signal clean. The name repeats on all bandwidths as a voice pattern and also as machine code, arithmetical sequence, and compressed picked representation." Sturm fell silent. He reached for a cup of caffeine on the edge of the chart table, his hand trembling. "A blanket broadcast."
"They certainly want us to know," Gaunt said.
Kaul looked round at him.
"They want us to be scared," he said snidely. "Just hours ago you complimented me on my ability to control information. We can presume the enemy are similarly efficient. This could be propaganda, demoralizing broadcasts. They may simply be using the name as a terror device."
"Possibly. But we agreed it would take a force of great charisma to turn a hive the size of Ferrozoica. Heritor Asphodel is just such a force. His fate and whereabouts since Balhaut are unknown."
Anko looked away from Gaunt deliberately and turned to Kaul. "You were on Balhaut, Kaul. What is this creature?"
Kaul was about to speak when Gaunt cut across. "Both Kaul and I served on Balhaut. I believe the Commissar was deployed on the southwest continent, away from the main battle for the oligarchy. I encountered the Heritor's forces personally."
Kaul conceded. He could barely hide his bitterness at the memory. "The Colonel Commissar may have more experience than me."
Crow turned his hooded eyes back to Gaunt.
"Well?"
"The Heritor was one of Archon Nadzibar's foremost lieutenants, a warlord in his own right, personally commanding a force of over 1 million. He was one of the chief commanders Nadzibar gathered in his great retinue to form the vast enemy force which overran the Sabbat worlds, Emperor damn him. Despite the notoriety of the other warlords, filth like Sholinskara, Nokad the Belighted, Anakwana Sek, Cux of the Eyeless, Heritor Asphodel remains the most notorious. His sworn aim, both before and after Archon Nadzibar co-opted him into the Pact, was to inherit Imperium world after Imperium world and return them to what he saw as the true state of chaos. His ruthlessness is immeasurable, his brutality staggering, and the charismatic force of his personality as a leader cannot be underestimated. And with the possible exception of Sek, he is probably the most tactically brilliant of all Nadzibar's commanders."
"It almost sounds like you admire the bastard," sniffed Sturm.
"I do not underestimate him, General," Gaunt said coldly. "That is different."
"And he could be here? It could be more than an enemy lie?"
Anko asked, failing to disguise the wobble in his voice.
"The Heritor fled Balhaut along with all the surviving warlords after Warmaster Slado slew the Archon. This may be his first reappearance. The Zoican forces have encircled us well and swiftly, and they have used both waiting and surprise to great effect. Both are tactics I know the Heritor favors. Furthermore, he delights in war machines. With access to Ferrozoica Hive's fabricating plants, the Baroque war machines we have seen are precisely the sort of things I would expect him to send out at us."
Crow said nothing as he took it in.
"Suggestions?" "Gaunt?"
Astutely, Gaunt deferred to Kaul, aware of how the Commissar was bristling at what he would no doubt see as the Colonel Commissar's grandstanding.
I would invite Commissar Cowell's ideas on how to deal with this information. Cowell greedily accepted the scrap thrown to him. We can't shut out blanket broadcasts, so we must refute them. All military, municipal, and guilder institutions in Vervenhive, along with select representatives of the citizenry and the legislature, must be clearly and emphatically briefed that this is hollow propaganda. We should prepare statements for the public address plates to repeat denials of this. I also urge we counter with broadcasts of our own. Simple repeats of the statement, "The Heritor is dead," should suffice for now.
Begin the work. I want regular updates. Crow waited as Cowell saluted and left, then faced Sturm and Zance. Battle standby remains in force, but I want all military resources moved into position now. No reserves. We must meet the next thrust with absolute power. Both generals nodded.
I trust the revisions you ordered to the communications net have been effected, General Sturm?
New channel settings and new codes have been issued to our forces. The confusions of the last storm should not recur.
Gaunt hoped Sturm was correct. He had reviewed the general's revisions, and they seemed sound, though they favored the Volpone Bluebloods and the Vervan Primary with the most accessible bands.
"Have you yet considered my proposal to engage them outside the wall?" asked Zance.
"Impractical, General," replied Crow.
"We saw how the Vervan mechanized were destroyed in the grasslands," Sturm added.
"But now they are dug in and restricted by the streets of the Outer Habs. The policy vouched by Nash, Grismond, and Gaunt early on would seem more attractive now. The North Col and Narmethian armor could sally out with infantry support and shake them from their forward line."
Gaunt listened, fascinated. This was the first he had heard of Zance's plan. Clearly, Sturm, Anko, and Crow had made efforts to suppress it. It could not be coincidence that Zance was voicing it now in Gaunt's presence.
"No," barked Sturm, anger getting the better of him for a moment. "We will not dilute our resistance here by wasting manpower and machines in an external raid."
Zance shook his head and left the upper auditorium without saluting. Sturm looked over at Gaunt with a scowl.
"Don't even begin to think about supporting Zance, Gaunt. The Imperial forces here at Vervenhive will not go on the offensive now or in the foreseeable future."
Gaunt nodded, saluted, and left. He knew when it was time to argue, and he'd been sticking his neck out more than enough in the last few days. The Zoikans recommenced sporadic bombardment at dusk, throwing shells and rockets up at the curtain wall at a listless rate, more to annoy than to do any real damage. The wall positions returned fire intermittently whenever a target was designated by the spotters. Zoikan ground forces, edging closer to the wall, fired las and bolt rounds at the gates from foxhole cover and ditches. At Sondar Gate, Vervan Primary Corps, under Captain Cargin, elevated the armored domes of the electric rotating turrets and peppered the ground in range outside with torrents of heavy autofire. The new defenses at Vervaire Gate took their first battering. There was the punk punk of mortars dropping shells close to the skirts of the stone siege walls, and dirt clouds drifted back across the troops at the parapet. Fagor swiveled his scope, hunting for a target in the Hab waste beyond, and he quickly identified the rising tendrils of smoke from the concealed mortars. He ordered Bragg up to the wall line and spotted for him as Bragg loaded rocket grenades into his shoulder launcher. Then Fagor voxed to Rawn for permission to fire. Rawn was crossing the inner trenches below the gate when he received the request and told Fagor to hold fire. He hurried down a dugout towards the Volpone command section, a half-smashed rail carriage buried to the axles in ash and rubble and shielded along its length with flakboard, sandbags, and piled stone. Rawn had been ordered to coordinate the defense with his Volpone opposite number, but despite Sturm's communication review, or because of it, Rawn grimly suspected, the inter-unit vox links seemed stilted and slow. Two Bluebloods of the elite 10th Brigade stood guard at the gas-curtained entrance. They were giants in their carapace battle dress, the gray and gold of their segmented armor-plass and fatigues spotless and austere. Each carried a gleaming black hellgun with a sawn-off pump gun attached to the bayonet lug under the main barrel. They blocked his advance.
"Major Rawn, Tanith Area Commander," he said briskly, and they stood aside to let him enter.
Colonel Nicolas Tachin de Hant Corday was a true blue blood. Massive, powerful and square-jawed, with hooded eyes. He was sitting at his chart desk in the carriage as Rawn entered, and he looked the Tanith over like he was something he'd found adhering to his boot. Rawn nodded. "I wish to commence discriminate return of fire. There are mortars trying to range my positions." Corday looked at his chart again and then nodded. "Do you want support?" "They're simply harrying, biding their time. But I'd rather not sit my men there while they find their true range."
"Is it worth drawing up the artillery?"
Rawn shook his head. "Not yet. Let me silence the mortars and see what they try next."
"Very good."
Rawn turned to leave.
"Major? Rawn, isn't it?"
Rawn turned back to see that Corday had risen to his feet.
"I am anxious that the Volpone and the Tanith can complement each other in this position," he said.
"I share your hope."
"There is not a good record between our regiments."
Rawn was surprised by the frankness.
"No. No, there isn't. May I ask, do you know why?"
Corday sighed.
"Voltamand. I was not part of that action, but I have reviewed the records. A miscalculation on General Sturm's part caused artillery to injure your units in the field."
Rawn coughed gently. It was a polite and rather inaccurate appraisal, but he didn't want to antagonize the Blue Blood officer.
"I don't believe the Volpone have ever formally apologized to the Tanith for it. For what it's worth, I make that apology now."
"Is there a reason?" Rawn asked guardedly.
"One of my men, Kalkis, speaks highly of the ghosts, of your Colonel Corbeck in particular. He fought with them on Nacidon. Others have praised Gaunt's leadership on Monthax."
Corday smiled. The smile seemed genuine, despite the aristocratic languor of the face. Rawn thought it would not be impossible to like Corday.
"Sturm, Emperor Onahim, Gilbert, many of the upper echelon will, of course, despise the Tanith for eternity."
They both laughed.
"But you'll find me a fair man, Rawn. We Bluebloods have prided ourselves on our superiority for a long time. It is time we learned from others and realized that the Imperial Guard has other fine regiments within it that we might be honored and educated to serve alongside."
Rawn was quietly astonished. Like all the ghosts, he had come to loathe the Bluebloods, and for a damaged, hating soul like Rawn, that loathing came easy. He could never have believed he would hear such comradeship from one of them, especially a senior officer.
"I appreciate your words, Colonel. I will bear them in mind and circulate your thoughts amongst my own men. It's fair to say that unless we learn to fight together, we will die here."
"In the spirit of cooperation, may I note that our inter-unit vox links are still unreliable?"
Corday nodded and made a note on his data slate with a stylus.
"Select Band Pi as a working link, with Band Kappa as reserve. I think I'll send one of my subalterns with a vox set to work as liaison. I suggest you reciprocate."
Rawn nodded, saluted, and left the carriage. Corday called his bodyguard in to join him.
"Send Graven to the Tanith position with a vox set. Tell him to act as intermediary. I want these disgusting ghost scum kept sweet. Make that clear to him. We don't want them hanging our asses out to dry when the fighting starts."
Returning down the trench, Rawn sent a confirmation to Fagor at the leading wall. Bragg's launcher thumped, and the mortar position erupted in a sheet of flame and debris as its munitions were hit. After a while, Lasfire began to pepper back from the Zoican lines. The ghosts kept their heads down and waited. At Hass East Fort, overlooking the estuary inlet, it was deathly quiet. Hass East had been spared all the fighting so far, but the position was still vital, as it watched the Vanik Highway and guarded the Ontabi gate entrance to the Hive, the only one of the five great city gates not yet assaulted. On the high top of the tower, Sergeant Vahl gazed out across the dusk, settling on the reed banks and islets of the matte-grey river. Waders and flycatchers darted and warbled over the water and rushes, and the riverside air was crazy with billowing gnats. The great bulk of the Heraldi Road Bridge to the north was just a silhouette. The rain had eased off. There was a smell of thunder in the air. Vahl, with two platoons of Tanith, was sharing defense of the fort with three platoons of Rowan Deepers under Captain Willard, and 300 Vervan primary gunners and wall artillerymen answering to Major Rodian, a junior member of one of the lesser noble houses. Varl got on with Willard. The Rome was about 25, tanned and shaggy blonde, with penetrating brown eyes and an earthy sense of humor. Like Varl, Willard had a metallic implant, in his case, the fingers and palm of his right hand. They joked together about their experiences of body automation. Rodian was rather more difficult. Although they all faced death here, Rodian had a more personal stake because this was his home. He was pale, earnest, and prematurely balding, though he was only in his early 20s. He seemed utterly mystified by the jokes and quips that rattled freely between his two fellow officers, and he would stare at them myopically through the half-moon glasses that were permanently perched on the bridge of his nose. Varl understood that House Rodian was one of the liberal families in the Hive, more humanitarian and forward-thinking than the old noble houses or the guilders. House Rodian's fortunes were built on food sources, and their harvester machines grazed the great pastoral uplands north of the Haas, gathering grain for the fast granaries in the dock district. Varl liked Rodian, but he didn't seem much of a soldier. The Tanith sergeant crossed the tower top, slapping gnats off his skin, and toured the emplacements as the daylight faded. He heard laughter and saw Willard and some of his tan-uniformed troops joking by a rocket station. Rodian stood a little apart, scoping the river and the road with a high-power set of magnoculars. Willard greeted Varl.
"But for these bloody flies, Ghost, I'd say we've pulled the best duty here. None of that bloody fighting stuff up here at Haas East, eh?"
Varl had already seen fighting in Vervenhive, and was actually glad of the calm and quiet up here on the far eastern side of the city. But still, waiting was sometimes the mind killer.
"Wouldn't object to a few Zykans to pop, though," he grinned.
"Hell no! A few of those bloody yellows to keep my eye in, eh?"
More laughter. Varl saw how Rodian shifted uncomfortably, unwilling to be drawn in. The Major took his duties and his war seriously. Too seriously, in Varl's opinion, probably because he'd never been in one before.
"See anything?" Varl asked, joining Rodian at the parapet.
"A little river traffic. Barges, ferries. Most of them are crossing from the north bank with munition hauls. House Command has embargoed all but vital supply runs."
Varl took his own single-lens scope from his pack and scanned the area. To the north of their position, near the bridge, sat the bulky promethium tanks of the dockside fuel depot, the main facility serving Vervenhive. On stilt legs, pipelines tracked away to the north and east, as far into the distance as Varl could see. They'd once pumped the fuel in from Vanik Hive, before it was lost. Now, the only liquid fuel supplies available to Vervenhive were coming from North Coal.
"Looks quiet enough," Varl said.
Behind them, Willard finished a particularly coarse joke, and the laughter of his men echoed down the battlements into the deepening gloom. Gilder Wallin returned to his guild house at nightfall. He was grinning broadly, and his face was shiny with the glow of too much jalik. An extraordinary guild meeting conducted in an armored bunker under the Commercia had left his personal resources three times the size they had been that dawn. The considerable Promethean reserves he had to bargain with had been snapped up greedily in a bidding war between five major guild carders, and he'd also managed to draw up a resourcing agreement with representatives of Vervan Primary. His pipeline was still drawing fuel into the massive steel bowsers in the wall and commercial estates on the river. Vanik Hive might be dead, but its legacy lingered on, and Wallin was amassing a trade fortune with every drop of it. By the time the war was over, Wallin was assured of a place in the high circle of the Commercia guilds. House Wallin would effect a promotion to the senior echelon of Hive trade institutions. Its stock price alone had quadrupled since the first storm. He sat in his private office, at a teak-topped desk with built-in picked plates, and sipped an over-filled glass of jalik as he reviewed the messages his communicator had collected during the day. One stopped him in his tracks. It was a notification of inquiry from some nobody called Kurth at Inner Hab Collective Medical Hall 67 MV. It wanted to know his whereabouts on the first day of attack. Had he been anywhere near Carriage Station C7D? There were irregularities that demanded investigation, and they were taking statements from anybody who had been in the area at that time. Monitor viewers along the access ramp had recorded him and two of his houseguard crossing that way during the bombardment of the Commercia. The message was signed Kurth A, and copied to an off-worlder medic named Dorden, one of the Imperial Guard. Warlin realized his hand was shaking, and he was slopping Jalik out of the glass. He set it down and sucked the drops off the ball of his thumb. He checked his weapon was still in the drawer of the desk. This annoyance would need to be dealt with quickly. The chatter was now so persistent that there was no other sign or meaning to the world. Salvador Sondar spasmed gently in his fluid world, gnawing at his lips. The voice of his worthy Ferrozoican cousin, Klatch, had been whittled away until it simply repeated two words over and again. A name. A demonic name. Sondar was emaciated and weak with hunger. His feeder tubes had long since run dry, and he had not the presence of mind to cycle the automated systems to refresh them. Even his meat puppets were forgotten and slowly rotting as they dangled lifelessly from their strings. A rich smell of decay filled the High Master's chambers. He was oblivious. He knew what the chatter wanted. The notion appealed to him, because the chatter made it so appealing. He couldn't form a coherent thought. He simply listened. Perhaps he would do it, just to shut the chatter up. Any time now. Larkin had been perfectly still for over an hour. His eye never left the scope sight. The spoilhead manufactory around him was quiet and dark, but he was aware of the Vervan sniper Lotin crouched behind rubble further down the second-story room. 10 minutes before, Larkin had sensed movement down on the spoil. He'd watched for it again, and now he saw it, a brief flash of moonlight on armor. He retrained his aim, breathed. The Zoikans were advancing up the spoil. They were well-drilled and as stealthy as any practiced insurgency team. It was clear they had either switched their distinctive ochre armor for dull night-fighting kit or had covered the livid yellow with soot. He signaled his intelligence to McColl over the Voxlink, using only half a dozen code words. McColl ordered the Tanith snipers to address and fire when they had a target. A second later, Ormond delivered the same command to his own men. Larkin saw movement again, clearly in the foggy green glow of his scope. He breathed, squared, and fired. The stinging red pulse whipped down the ore slope, and a black-clad figure was thrown up and backwards. Larkin immediately dipped under the edge of the rubble and took a new position. He was certain his muzzle flash had been discreet, but there was no sense in advertising. He made his new vantage and aimed again, his extended barrel hidden inside a broken drain gutter. Lotin, 10 meters away, fired. His lasgun made a loud crack, and even from where he was, Larkin saw the muzzle flash and cursed. He heard Lotin complain over the Voxlink. It missed. Move. Move and re-aim, Larkin willed silently. Lotin fired again. His whoop of success was quickly cut short by a perfectly aimed las round from the spoil below. The Zoikans had been watching for a repeat flash. Lotin toppled back and slumped into the rubble scree on the floor, his face gone. So, thought Larkin, they have capable and careful snipers too. This war just got interesting. The night was on them now, and the moons, two large and cream and one tiny and livid red, climbed slowly into a purple sky. Rain clouds, black and woolly, chased along the eastern skyline. Distant thunder rolled out in the grasslands. The air was sultry and unseasonable, and at Haas East Fort, Val was sweating freely into his black fatigues. The discomfort was made worse by the static build-up generated by the vast shield behind them, fizzing and crackling in the dark, a glowing hemisphere of energy. The plating of his lasgun and his bionic arm tingled with electricity. Val yearned for the threatening storm to break over them and clear the stifling air. There was a brutal flash from the northeast, and then an ear-splitting bang, followed by an impact that threw Val off his feet. Voices were shouting in the night, alarms were ringing, and someone was screaming in agony. The sky lit up again, Explosions were rippling along the entire stretch of curtain wall between Ontarby Gate and the Hass. Vaal got up, blinking. There was no sign of shelling. That had been mines. He ran down the parapet, yelling into his Voxlink as more explosions shook the wall. Detonating mines meant one thing only. The enemy was right on top of them, close enough to set charges. Men were milling all around, confused. Equally useless barks of Vox traffic answered Vaal. Vaal grabbed the wall for support as another explosion went off close by, flame slicking upwards in a tight ball inside the wall. Inside the wall. "They've penetrated! They've penetrated!" he bellowed, not understanding it, but desperate to get the message out. Almost at once, he came under fire. Las shots flicked the air around him, coming up from the nearest wall access stair. Vaal returned fire, rallying the Vervan primary troops nearest to him. Crackling autoguns began to support him. He saw Zoikan stormtroops spreading out onto the battlements from the stair access, their ochre armor dulled by dark, tarry stains. Vaal shot down one or two before realizing many more were storming the battlement behind him, too. How in the name of Feth had they got inside? A huge blast shook him to his knees. An entire section of Hass East collapsed with a roar, and brick dust billowed into the sky, underlit by flame. Further detonations sliced through the top of the wall. Vaal saw gun emplacements ripped apart and exploded, and he watched as entire sections of wall defenses blew outwards as mines set off ammunition silos and autoloader hoppers. Like the wrath of a ruthless god, the war had come to Hass East at last.